This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. To create your own space, visit squarespace.com and save 10% by using offer code TREK8. And also by TrekFan. It's not just a fan club, it's an adventure. You'll explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. Don't miss out. Help move us toward the Star Trek future by visiting TrekFan.org. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit Trek.fm/donate to get our new alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 106, Ancient Bajoran Parachute Pants. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including another run at the costume record at Star Trek Las Vegas, what DS9's logo could have been, the Enterprise spatula, QMX's NX-01 artisan replica, and John Eves' account of designing Into Darkness. Then in the feature, we're joined by Drew Stewart and Ben McCormick to discuss the DS9 episode, Explorers. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Matthew. It's great to have you back with me on the Ready Room. Finally, your vacation's over. It's been over for a while, but this is the first Ready Room to roll around with you co-hosting. How are you doing this week?
Chris, doing well. You're right. It's just been a busy, busy summer. I knew you wouldn't know what that's like. And so it's good to be back in the co-hosting chair. I feel a little bit like I'm Chakotay to your Janeway. You know, we don't really have a captain's chair per se, but we've got co-captains and... yeah, it's very egalitarian. It's, you know, nice.
I'm not sure what I think about that, Matthew. If I'm Janeway and you're Chakotay, I'm afraid to search Google or go to YouTube because I don't know what kind of fan fiction or what kind of music videos people are going to be making about us.
You know, Chris, I misspoke. I just wasn't thinking there. So yeah, just scratch that. No, it just reminds me of that captain's chair seat on Voyager, which, you know, Janeway didn't get her own middle chair. She had to share it, unfortunately. And so, but no, it's great to be back in the co-hosting seat here on the Ready Room.
Great. Well, before this goes any further downhill with talk of fan fiction and YouTube videos, let's just jump right on into the news here this week. And the first thing we've got up is Star Trek Las Vegas, which is coming up now in just a little over a week by the time this Ready Room drops, August 8th to the 11th at the Rio in Las Vegas. And the story is, creation is encouraging everyone to come out in their costumes to try to set a new world's record for largest gathering of people dressed as Star Trek characters.
Well, Chris, we had the record for a while. We had 1,040 fans. Then Star Trek London happened, and they just kicked our butts, and they had 1,063 fans. I think that the U.S. can do this. We've got a lot of Star Trek fans. It's Vegas. People like to dress up, do crazy things anyway. So let's make this happen, folks. I think the record belongs back here in the United States where Star Trek started.
Yeah, because often in Star Trek, the Federation is like America, right?
Exactly, exactly. And if we can't represent by having the most fans have the most amount of costumes on, come on, what's going wrong here?
Does it count? Now, Star Trek, of course, there are so many aliens running around. Do people not dressed in actual costumes, can they count? Can we say that they are aliens dressed as humans? They're in their human cosplay? Would that work?
Yeah, I think that could work. You know, I'm really disappointed, though. I mean, can I not come in my Bosom Buddy costumes?
Ooh,
doesn't count for the world record. I'm just a bosom buddy Star Trek fan.
Well, we're going to have to get technical here. On the one hand, I don't think that would work, because the record is for the largest gathering of people dressed as Star Trek characters. However, there's a loophole. We have to remind Guinness about that holodeck program where they reenact episodes of Bosom Buddies.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Because then, you know, if you dress like Kip, then it's fine, because you're actually a character from a Star Trek episode
in
a holodeck program. And so that's going to work
fine. I feel like this would be one of those lost episodes of Voyager where Harry Kim and Tom Paris are reenacting their favorite Bosom Buddy episodes. And good stuff there. I think this should count.
It really should. Yeah, we saw Captain Proton in Voyager. Actually, Captain Proton and Bosom Buddies were really tied for Tom and Harry as for their favorite pastimes. And it was perfect with the Delaney sisters, because if you remember on Bosom Buddies, you know, they had their friends who were women, and they hung out there in the apartment. So the Delaney sisters played that role. It was perfect. So I think you're right here.
The best unseen episode of Voyager ever.
Best ever. I'm hoping it's going to be on the remastered Blu-rays as an extra unaired episode.
Oh, one can only
now,
hope.
Now, you mentioned at Star Trek Las Vegas 2011 that they had 1,040 fans dressed as Star Trek characters. Now, StarTrek.com ran a story on this, and they said that Destination Star Trek London shattered the mark, amassing 1,063 fans in costume. And I don't know, does 23 more people actually qualify as shattering a record? I think they just topped it.
You know, I feel like that the writer for that StarTrek.com article just used a thesaurus, and
maybe
that was maybe one of the first words that came up, was shattered, for, you know, broke the mark. And just insert it there without realizing that the connotation that you get when you hear the word shattered means like they blew it out of the water. I mean, you know, you had 1,400 fans. We had 3,265. You know, that's shattering
that
the record.
That's shattered.
Exactly.
That's shattered, yes. So. Exactly. Exactly. All right. Well, anyway, here is the message, the official message from Creation. They say, the challenge has been made and you are invited to help us regain the championship for Vegas. Our attempt to break the record will occur on Saturday of the 2013 Las Vegas convention. Bring your costumes, bring your friends. Let's get the award back to Vegas. So everyone, if you're going to Vegas, make sure you take your costume with you and help bring that record back. Matthew, today in the feature, we're talking about Deep Space Nine. And this story came up over the past week. People were talking about Deep Space Nine's logo and how it could have looked quite different. And it's been presented as this was Deep Space Nine's original logo, and then they changed it. Now, Mike Okuda posted on TrekNews.net. He had the very first comment on the article that was posted there, and Mike Okuda said, there were over 150 different title typography treatments done for DS9. The version that's being shown everywhere this week on the blue background was not one of them. It was a temp version used for early publicity. So, you know, the story's kind of like everyone, I've seen it on many different sites, and it's kind of bringing up a discussion about nothing really, but let's just talk about it creatively for a minute. What do you think about this logo?
I really think that it's just kind of amateurish. It reminds me of something that a fan would have created, especially with the Starfleet insignia as the A. It just looks like something that someone would have come up with in early version of Illustrator or Photoshop. I think it would have been... It kind of has that next generation feel a little bit, just kind of 90-ified, if that's a word, since it's the 90s.
90-ified, that's a word.
Yeah. It really just doesn't look as classy as what we get when you get the official Deep Space Nine logo that looks very good, very in line with, you know, the progression of Starfleet logos, Star Trek show logos. And so this one just doesn't have that flair. It feels like it's stuck in the very early 90s.
Yeah, I agree. Again, I mean, as a designer, I look at this and I'm like, this is really bad work. But it does feel like, and I think this is what Mike is saying here, is this was just used for a few television promos. It almost feels like Paramount just handed it off to someone in a general design department. Probably like, again, I don't know who did it, but just designers within the general department, not necessarily tied to Star Trek. And they just said, we need a promo. This new show, Deep Space Nine, is coming out. We just need a couple of quick promos for it. And whoever did it, maybe not being a real Trekkie, thought, oh, this will be cool. Make it look kind of spacey. We'll put the A will be the insignia here. And it'll be cool. And they just threw it out there.
I just feel like Bill Cosby might wear it as a sweater, you know, from the Cosby Show. It just kind of has that feel to it. Those purples blues. And it just feels like a Bill Cosby sweater.
Well, it could be like the vanilla grape Jell-O pudding pop.
Exactly.
It's purple at the top. It's white at the bottom. Bill Cosby's licking that Jell-O pudding pop. Yeah. Exactly. Well, I'm glad that they didn't go with this, thank goodness, because even if it looked cool at the time, it's one of those designs that ages really quickly.
Yes.
And when we look at it now, we're like, that's like... It's like the 80s music. Now, I love 80s music because I grew up with it, but overall, it has that really distinct style to it,
yes,
right?
Yes, it very much does.
It's kind of like the 80s music of Star Trek logos. And I saw someone posted also in TrekNews.net that they like the actual Deep Space Nine logo because it's timeless. And I think that person makes a really good observation that it is timeless. You know, whether we saw it in the 90s or whether we look back at it even 30 years from now, the Star Trek Deep Space Nine logo will always look fine to us, I think. It's just, it's Star Trek, and it'll always be good.
Well, Chris, this is a really interesting story that ThinkGeek has thought up something new that you're just going to have for your kitchen. I didn't know that I was missing this until I saw the pictures. And then I realized that this is a must-have. Chris, it kind of bowled me over. It actually made me want to do a barrel roll. Into the kitchen as I flipped my pancakes with this brand new spatula that looks like the Enterprise. I don't know, Chris, what were your first thoughts when you looked at this?
Well, actually, my first thoughts were pretty much what you just said. I actually, when I put this story into the show notes today, I rewrote the original headline, and I wrote, ThinkGeek helps your food do barrel rolls with the Enterprise spatula, because that's exactly what it is, right? It's perfect. It's really interesting. It's now, to say that it looks just like the USS Enterprise, which is what ThinkGeek says on their website, I mean, kind of. It looks more like just like some of the artist renditions of the Enterprise as they were developing the ship, because it's a spatula, right? So it has to have this very flat surface for the saucer. And then from the hull, you have the hull, you have the nacelles, but then you have this just really thin metal bar going up to the very flat saucer section. So... But I have to say, you know, this might have been a better design because, as we always talk about, one of the design flaws for the Enterprise, whether it's the Constellation class or the Galaxy class, is that that big neck piece is just a very, very easy and tempting target for enemies in battle. And if you had this little narrow one, you'd have to be a really, really good shot to hit this with a torpedo.
Well, you would have to be a good shot, but I mean, if you actually hit it, I mean, I feel like the saucer section would just go flying in one way, the engineering section goes flying in another way. So, yeah, it'd
only take one shot, that's true. It just snap right in half.
What I'm really wondering, though, is, you know, you have the engineering section is where you hold the spatula, and you have to hold it. And there's even a picture of the hands kind of holding it around the nacelles and everything. Like, this looks very clumsy to try and use. Is that just me, Chris? Or I just, it doesn't seem like it's the easiest spatula in the world to be able to actually make my pancakes do barrel rolls.
Probably not. And if you hold it the way they're showing it in the image, you're probably going to burn your hand if you try to do that. I'm sure that because they're holding it the way that we're accustomed to the ship looking as it goes through space, which means that your hand is much lower than the actual surface of the spatula.
Right, exactly.
So your hand would be ramming into the side of the pan as you try to do that. I'm sure in practice you're going to want to hold this thing upside down and scoop the pancake. And then when you flip it over, then the ship would be upright the way we're accustomed to seeing it on screen. That would work.
Yeah, and unfortunately, too, this is not something I can just throw in the dishwasher, Chris. I got to hand wash this one. So that's what the instructions were for the product. So I don't know. This might be something that I might just skip, unfortunately.
Well, hand washing for me would be no problem. We hand wash our dishes pretty much all the time anyway. We don't have those giant American dishwashers here in Japan. We do have a dishwasher. It's a small one. But, you know, I find depending on what you wash in it, it's easier to just wash by hand in the first place. So I'd be okay with that. But I don't know. You know, this one hasn't quite captured my imagination in the same way that the Enterprise pizza cutter did, for example.
Now, those were fantastic. And then you had the Klingon Bird of Prey wine bottle opener corkscrew, which was fantastic.
Oh, and don't forget the Batleth letter opener.
Exactly.
Well.
So
awesome.
They have definitely been a role. I'm not sure if this one really continues that role, though.
Don't forget the inflatable captain's chair either.
Which is fantastic when you're in Texas and you wanted to float around in the pool, but you want to feel like a captain. Best way to do it.
That would be awesome. But if you are interested in this, you can find it over on the website. They previewed it at San Diego Comic-Con. It's $24.99. It's not available yet. It will be available sometime in August. They don't give an exact date. We don't know. Now, if they're going to be like Apple and they say available in August, that means August 31st. I don't know if ThinkGeek is going to follow that path or not, but you can go check it out. We'll put a link in the show notes. And they do have a video showing it in action. So if you want to go watch that, that's there too. Matthew, while we're talking about ships, this next story, it's no longer new. It's not a new story. It's been out for about 5 weeks or so now. I've just been sitting on it until you were back on the show as co-host again, because I really wanted to get your thoughts on this, because I know that you love to collect replica starships. I know that you're a huge fan of Enterprise. What do you think about QMX's $3,995 artisan replica of the Enterprise NX-01?
Chris, I have to say, she's gorgeous. It is a fantastic design. The way that they have created this for fans, I think they have given them probably the ultimate version of the NX-01 that you could own. It is a little bit out of my price range, being almost $4,000, probably with shipping it'd be about $4,000. But it looks just beautiful, and it really does look like it flew straight out of one of the episodes. You know, QMX does fantastic work. Honestly, if there was any ship that I could buy, it would be their version of the NCC 1701A that they did. That was $5,000, so I don't have that either, but they do such good work. I cannot imagine if you are the fan who has this kind of money. This is the ultimate, I think, replica of the NX-01.
Definitely. It is absolutely beautiful. The shots that they have of it, they've shot it in a darkened room so that you can really see the LEDs illuminating everything. They have more than 150 LEDs on this ship, including the torpedoes and the phaser arrays and the warp engines, the impulse engines, the Bussard collectors, the navigational deflector arrays, especially on the front. You know, Enterprise NX-01 has that cool, very thin, it's kind of like a proto deflector array, right? I guess, because we're accustomed to the big round dishes on the 24th century ships. But It's beautiful the way it's lit up blue, and just really fantastic design. It's on the one hand, it's a shame that these things cost $4,000. On the other hand, these are build to order. So, you know, they're not making 500 of these and just waiting for people to come buy them. You have to order this ship. And there are some things that you can do to customize it as well. That it comes on a mirrored base. It's a 28-inch long base. It's 18 inches wide and it's 1 inch high. And, you know, the bases that they do for their ships really do enhance the workmanship of the craft itself as
well. They really do.
And in this case, you can actually customize the base. You can choose the color. They have champagne, steel, copper, or bronze, or you can get a combination of these colors. And it can be mirrored, or it can be gloss black, or it can be white. And you can even have a phrase of your choice inscribed on the base. Of course, that's for an additional charge, but it's kind of like the way you have your used to get your iPods engraved on the back. You know, it's kind of like that. What would you put on it if you were going to get your NX-01 base engraved as an Enterprise fan? What would you put on there?
You know, it'd probably be something just really basic, like these are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. You know, something like that. That, you know, I can't think of anything else I'd really want on there. You know, I don't want my name or anything like that. I'd want it to reflect the show. I'd want it to stay classy. And I feel like if I put anything else on there, I'm not sure. I don't know. What, Chris, did you think of anything that you'd put on there?
Well, I did. And like you, I want it to be true to the show. It has to be connected to Enterprise, the show itself. When I order mine, I'm going to have "Don't Feed Him Cheese" inscribed on the bottom. Do you think that's a bad move for something that's going to cost me $4,000?
You know, Chris, I feel like you're going to be that guy that walks out of the tattoo parlor at, you know, 4 a.m. with a tramp stamp. I really think that's what the feeling is going to be if you put that phrase on there. I could be wrong. It happens in life, but I think this one I might be right about.
Okay, well, maybe. You know, I was going to go with the champagne coloring along with the cheddar option that they have, and then I was going to have "Don't Feed Him Cheese" on.
Yeah, but to each his own, Chris. Who am I to judge? I would say though, the resale value may dip quite significantly if that is what you put on there. So just FYI, I mean, it you know, you can do whatever you want though. It'll be your ship. It's your $4,000.
All right. Well, I'll think about it.
Okay.
I'll reconsider.
Okay. Well.
So. This is going to be a 1/350 scale model. It's 23.5 inches long by 16 inches wide, 5 inches high. It's 11 inches high when mounted on the base. And, of course, it's built to the exact specifications and dimensions of the CG Studio model. So, seriously, I won't be ordering one because I don't have $4,000 to order a ship with. But if I did, and I were collecting these, I would love to add this to my collection because it's absolutely beautiful and it's just amazing work. Matthew, as we're talking about designing things, this is a story I saw on StarTrek.com and I found it very interesting. John Eaves, who is an artist who worked on Star Trek Into Darkness, talked about designing for the film. And what I found interesting about it is that he did a lot of design work for the film in the dark, no pun intended, because of the secrecy surrounding the film. And it reminded me a little bit of especially Star Wars Episode One, where the actors in the movie really didn't know the movie, especially the extras. You know, I always remember that scene where Queen Amidala, they're talking about the blockade, and you get you're like, this scene is terrible. I don't believe anything that the actors are saying, and the acting is bad. And then you think, well, you know, they have no idea what they're talking about. They're acting out one scene, and they don't know how it fits into the movie. And so how can you really do that when you don't know what you're actually filming? Now, luckily, I think John Eaves did a much, much better job of working on this movie, not really knowing exactly what he was building. What did you think about this, Matthew?
Chris, I just thought this was really interesting, the way that, Into Darkness was really created in the dark for a lot of people, just who some of the characters were going to be, obviously, with, it's going to be Khan. Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the film, I apologize. John Harrison is Khan. So John Eaves, in the same way, really designing, not realizing that he's designing some props for Khan. This character that he was designing for was called April, which is interesting because we know April was in the comic series before the film, but he doesn't actually show up in the movie. And then just the idea that as a film, you are creating all of these things that may or may not get used. And I thought it was really interesting him talking about, and I've seen this a lot with Lucas and his work, and Star Wars and stuff. He has so many things going on being created, but so little of it actually gets to be used in the film because there's only so much you can put on screen. But Lucas Archives is full of drawings and maquettes and all sorts of things that they've created just to get, like, say, one character. In the same way here, John Eaves is really working very hard to create some things that we'd see on Nibiru, but really get shrunk down by the time they actually get to the film because of budgetary reasons and the way the film, starts to be laid out. So all that work really doesn't even get seen, but it's still all there for the film.
Exactly. Yeah. He has some images here in the story of, blowguns and other types of artifacts and tools and such that he created for the tribe on Nibiru. Shows a little bit of, researching tribes here on Earth and the inspirations for those. A lot of great sketches here about what the Nibiru might have looked like originally, which is a bit different from what they actually look like in the movie. You can kind of see how they didn't go this route. Because really these sketches, I guess you would have had to have either done the Nibiru as CGI, or it would have been some really serious makeup work, which would have cost a lot of money to create that many people that they needed to create. But very cool to see how the thought process goes. And one of them, he has a running stick that's a rock-throwing device for the Nibiru, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, they apparently liked lacrosse. Big lacrosse
apparently,
players.
Yes. So. I think so. It's exactly what it looks like. This will make great material for the Art of Star Trek Into Darkness book, which, as far as I know, they haven't announced that yet, have they? But I'm sure they'll do one. They did one for the 2009
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I would think that they would do something like this. And it'd be really good to see all that went into creating so many of these things we saw in the film, because there were a lot of points in the movie where you could tell there was a lot more that was, that they had planned or just that they would have liked to put on screen, but, you can only do in so much time. And so it just shows how talented these guys are to be able to create this stuff and not necessarily know what it is they're designing, but they're just letting their imaginations go. And this is what comes out. And I think it's really cool to be able to see that, just the talent behind Star Trek. And, John Eaves been a part of Star Trek for a long time. I mean, created one of my favorite starships, the Enterprise E. A man who really knows what he's doing when it comes to designing Star Trek.
Definitely. So if you want to check this out, go over to StarTrek.com. We'll put a link in the show notes and you can check out the artwork there. And also, we just touched on a few items here. It's a pretty long piece, and John actually goes in depth into how he was brought into working on Into Darkness in the first place, about what the production process was like, when different parts of the team were brought in at different times during the development of the film. And he started working on it in August 2011. He was actually asked to start, or he was invited to be part of the team, January 2011. So that shows you, how long things were going on. So it's a really interesting piece. So go check that out over at StarTrek.com. Well, Matthew, that's all we have in news this week. But before we jump into our Deep Space Nine feature, let's tell our listeners a little bit about our sponsor for this week's show, Squarespace. Now, your support of our sponsors is really important to helping us bring the Ready Room to you every week, and we'd love for you to check out Squarespace. They're the all-in-one platform that combines hosting and content management to make it simple for you to create your own space online. And that could be a blog, it could be a website, a portfolio, or an online store. I've been a Squarespace user myself for the past 6 years. I build not only my company's website, but Trek FM is built on Squarespace. I build websites for clients on Squarespace, and my personal blog is there as well. And you know, apart from the simple fact that the tools are really awesome, what I really like about Squarespace is that they are constantly improving their platform. They're adding new features, new designs, and even better support, which is amazing because they have the best support you're going to find anywhere. But they're always striving to improve that. And I love that about them. It's incredibly easy to use, but if you want some help, they're there for you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And amazingly, that great support and all these amazing tools starts at just $8 a month. And if you sign up for the annual plan, you can even get a free custom domain name. So it's really an amazing service. And Matthew, why don't you tell everyone about 3 points about Squarespace that really show why it is the platform to choose when you want to create an online presence?
Well, Chris, I think one that's really important to me is that Squarespace is design focused. I don't know about you, but I really hate going to a website that everything is so cluttered. It's hard for me to be able to find anything. It's so overdone that I'm really missing, I think, what the website's meant to do, which is to give me whoever's doing this website their content. And Squarespace really helps you do that. Their templates are extremely clean, and they allow your content to take the focus of the website, which is so important. I mean, you know, if you're writing a blog or you're creating a store and showcasing your work art-wise, you really want that to be what stands out, not the website itself. You want it to be easy to navigate and to use, and Squarespace does that really well. And then, of course, if you're creating, say, a blog or some sort of store where you're selling your merchandise or any of those kind of things, you're going to want to be able to connect your site to all the different accounts that are out there, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Instagram, Google, all of these social network sites that really help you to be able to get your content out there. Squarespace makes that easy. You don't have to worry about that. It helps you link to all those accounts and be able to share very quickly what you're doing on your blog right away with your followers. And then for the most important thing, I think, now these days, Chris, is that, you know, you have an iPad, I have an iPad, we both have iPhones. We tend to look up websites on those. Nothing is more frustrating than going to a website and having to try and navigate on especially your iPhone or your mobile device and not having the website be responsive to the mobile design, but also have it be a smart mobile design so it doesn't feel watered down. It just feels like a better, easier to use website on your device. Squarespace does that perfectly. It has unique mobile design so that every time somebody visits your site from, say, a phone or some sort of iPad or some tablet or something like that, your site automatically scales to look beautiful on every device, which is, you know, really important, again, if you're trying to have your content take first stage.
Most definitely. That's been a huge time-saving feature for me because I no longer have to worry about building one version for the desktop and one version for mobile. It's a great feature. And, you know, another great feature that they added recently is the e-commerce feature. So if you want to set up a shop and sell things, you can do that in just a matter of minutes, including the ability to process credit cards online, which is, of course, very important if you want to actually sell something and make it easy on your customers. So that's there now as well. And you can do all of this without any coding knowledge whatsoever. You can create a beautiful website, beautiful blog, beautiful store. You don't need to know how to code anything. But if you do love to code and you want to have complete, total control over every little aspect of your website and its code, you can do that too because Squarespace has a fantastic developers platform that you can access. But don't take our word for it. Try this for yourself. We would love for you to go and find out firsthand why I build all my websites on Squarespace, and Why Trek FM is built there as well. Just go to squarespace.com to start a free 14-day trial. There's no credit card required. Just enter your name and email address, and in a matter of minutes, you'll be building your website. If you already use a platform like WordPress, you can import your website from there, see how it's going to look on Squarespace, see how the Squarespace tools give you everything you need to create an exceptional website or blog. Then when you decide to sign up, and I know you're going to want to, make sure to use our offer code TREK8 to get 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And as I mentioned at the beginning, if you choose the annual option, you'll also receive a free domain registration. So support our sponsor and support the Ready Room. Visit squarespace.com and use offer code TREK8. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM. And we thank you for supporting Squarespace, and that helps us bring this programming to you every week. During the second season, DS9 focused its stories more and more on characters, but as Jake grew up, it became harder to figure out how to handle that father-son relationship with Sisko. But in the third season, the perfect story came along, pitched by show intern Hilary Bader. Today we're going to talk about this episode, Explorers, and all the seeds it planted for later DS9, and to help us do that, we have with us our TOS editor, Drew Stewart. Hello, Drew.
Good joy to you, my friends. I forgot what my slogan was. I need to write it down.
Have you been on vacation, Landry? What's happening to all those people there? What's happening to the Archons?
They're not returning anymore, I tell you that.
They've had enough joy. Also back with us for the first time in a long time from the Doctor Who podcast, and someone you'll also know from Dork Trek, it's friend of the show, Ben McCormick. Ben, it's so good to have you back with us.
Hey, Chris. I guess the red hour did not take me down as it did with Landru. But no, it's good to be back on the podcasts of any kind.
It's really great. You know, we've had some people ask us, where's Ben? We haven't heard Ben in ages. So I know a lot of listeners are going to be glad to hear you today.
I had to come out of semi-retirement.
Well, we're glad you did.
He's like that football player person.
The
one
Favre.
Who keeps coming back. That one.
Yeah.
Brett Favre.
Brett Favre.
That football player person. It's been a long time since we've talked sports ball on the Ready Room,
yeah.
Hasn't it?
Welcome back, sports ball. It's almost like, Chris, you know that you and I are going to be talking some serious sports ball once college football rolls around, so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, hey, we got some sports ball worked into literary tricks.
I know.
Week,
so I mean,
we're already,
you're going to have to make
Alabama.
Another podcast. Yeah. The sports ball. Call it the sports ball.
I thought about
like
the sports
orb, ball. But the sports ball.
To the sports ball!
Now, Ben, like me, you are a native Alabaman. I can't remember if I've ever asked you, are you Alabama or Auburn?
Well, it's Roll Tide all the way in my home.
All right. So. That's my man.
He doesn't have to kick you off. That's good.
You can stay. You can stay on the show.
If I'd said, I think I saw in the notes, if you say Auburn, you're booted. So.
That's right. If you say Auburn, we're going to make you use the bathroom on the solar sail ship even after we return to deep space.
And then we're going to turn off the gravity.
Exactly. So good luck with
right.
that.
All right. Well, it is DS9 week again on the Ready Room. And Matthew, you chose Explorers this week. So why don't you get us rolling here?
You know, Chris, when we were thinking about episodes and we had a limited number of what we could do because Drew's only seen so many and we didn't want to make him watch something out of order yet. And so I was looking through the episodes and Explorers has really just always been one of my favorite episodes. And one of the reasons is because it's one of those Deep Space Nine episodes that's really based on the characters. It really kind of gets into Sisko's psyche. Who he is as a character, what drives him, obviously, his relationship with Jake, his family, but just this, he has this deep thirst to understand the world around him, which I think is really awesome to get to see, especially in a captain, but also see Sisko do something about it, which is great in this episode. I mean, he takes time off of work, he builds this ship, he's going to prove that these Bajorans could do this. And this really, I think, too, and in some ways, helps solidify his closeness to the Bajoran people, which is something that grows throughout the seasons. And this is a very organic thing that you see there. And then on the other side, this is a great Bashir and O'Brien show. And this is really the one I think that cements their friendship. So for me, I love watching this episode to watch those two guys really kind of come together and become the friends that they will be for the, you know, the next set of seasons. And so this is, to me, just classic Deep Space Nine, really at its best, doing character episodes, which for me are the heart and soul of Deep Space Nine.
Any first impressions of Explorers, Ben? Do you remember this coming on the first time and watching this? I remember feeling like, wow, this is a really different Deep Space Nine episode.
Yeah, for me, you know, the interesting thing is I have not seen this episode since probably it first came on. Jenny and I have kind of on and off been watching Trek on the Netflix. And one of the things, you know, I've been trying to keep stuff that she's seen, but I'll, you know, kind of watch ahead. And I didn't realize how much of this, you know, of Deep Space Nine, of all Star Trek, that it's just been ages since I've seen some of these episodes. And I honestly probably haven't watched this one since it first aired, what, in 95, I think?
95, yeah.
Yeah, so I was probably still, this was just before I joined the Navy, so, you know, and actually went sailing on the real sea. But this was one of the episodes for me. I was an Avery Brooks fan from when he was on the old A Man Called Hawk series from Spencer for Hire. Yeah. So when he first showed up in Deep Space Nine, no goatee, and he had hair. Now, all of a sudden, this episode, the goatee's back, and it's like, you know, this is the Hawk that I remember. This is, you know, he's slowly getting back to the tough look that I recalled. And so it was interesting to see, you know, it's kind of like the whole thing with TNG with the beard coming for Riker that, you know, is this a change point? Is this going to do like the last show did? And I think this was part of, you know, things to come.
I'm glad they had Avery grow the beard and not Nana, because if Kira had grown the beard, it would have really sent the show in another direction.
We should check to see if that was a behind-the-scenes thing, you know, if Larry could get some details on that for us, because it's one of those things where, you know, well, there were some discussions, and Ira had wanted Kira to grow the beard, but
we rolled a D20. And to see which character of all of our characters would grow a beard. It landed on Odo first.
Right, they had a lineup. They had all the characters grow the beard to see who it looked best on.
Well, I just can't imagine, you know, Deep Space Nine being the place where you would come and be like, oh, yes, we have the bearded lady. Her name is Kira. I mean, it's a little too much of a circus town at that point, you know?
It's some sign from the prophets.
Exactly. That's where the ostriches running around on the promenade would make a lot more sense.
Exactly.
A little sideshow. So, Drew, you're bringing a new perspective to DS9 to us because you are our TOS guy and you're watching DS9 for the first time. And I guess you're about through the fourth season.
I'm about now. So we picked just over halfway through the fourth season.
Right. So we picked an episode that's something within the range that you had seen. And what were your impressions of this episode, seeing it for the very first time?
Seeing it for the very first time.
First watch of DS9.
Yeah, about a couple months ago when I watched it for the first time, I was disappointed because again, like we talked about on the orb, it at this point, it hadn't grabbed me yet. It grabbed me like during the search and stuff, and you know, the founders and the Dominion and all that kind of stuff. And after that point, I assumed that the show would just be, you know, the Dominion is this ever looming threat. And then this episode comes up where Sisko builds a ship out of wood and takes his son to sail into enemy territory undefended. I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. Now looking at it, having gone forward a season and a half, probably beyond this point, or maybe a full season, I could see more of the Benjamin Jake and the especially the Bashir O'Brien relationship that I've been looking at specifically since I started Deep Space Nine, because yeah, that's what Matthew and I are.
Well, that leads us into the first big topic, really, which is the big setup. And Ben, you already mentioned the beard, and we talked about the beard here. Mm-hmm. One thing I had forgotten too, because I watched this episode sometime within the last year. I actually popped my DVD into the computer, and when it started playing this disc, it was in the middle of this episode. So this was apparently the last episode that I watched from this disc. Although I usually don't use my DVDs. I have everything ripped into iTunes, but it's been a while since I saw it. And even then, I had forgotten how much stuff this particular episode sets up for the series that's important to the series. Of course, Sisko grows the beard. He starts that transition to the Sisko look that I think we all like better than yes. the first season look.
Definitely.
But of course, Miles and Jules are cementing their bromance here with this just fantastic drunken night in the quarters. Lita is introduced in this episode. Cassidy is introduced in this episode, not by name, but the fact that Jake is about to introduce his father to Cassidy, which of course is very important as the series goes on. And Jake's writing career gets started in this episode as well. So there's just so much stuff here.
Yeah, this episode feels like when we were talking about the first season, you need to watch all of the episodes to really get a feel for all of the characters, or it's not as satisfying later on. And even though this isn't my favorite episode, it does introduce a lot of things that may not even be important later, but things that would mean more, like Cassidy coming because Jake doesn't want his dad to be alone when he goes away to college, is really sweet and something that you might, if you just skip over this episode or forget about it, you know, you're just like, oh, he's going to meet this captain lady. You know, who cares? But this, you know, you get the backstory that's needed to really make it sink in.
Well, and one of the cool things, too, is you see, it's a funny scene, is, you know, when Lita is introduced here, you know, she comes over and she obviously thinks the doctor is cute, you know, and she's flirting with him by telling him that she has a cough and all this, and they're playing that game. And then Dak shows up, you know, the kind of the heartthrob for Bashir for so long, you know, and he does that wonderful thing with the pad where he, you know, types in the message, go away, yes. Which is just
without
fantastic.
Pushing any buttons.
Exactly.
Well, he pushes two buttons. So I'm thinking swipe technology on the pads in the future is greatly improved over the swipe technology we have right now with our
exactly.
pads.
Maybe. Well, we know that pads in the 24th century are single function devices.
Right.
You know, you can only have one document per pad. That's mm-hmm. probably Bashir's pickup pad. He keeps it in his uniform. And those buttons are programmed. One of them is programmed to type go on the screen. The other one's programmed to type away. He just tap, tap, and he hands it to somebody and go away. That's the only thing that pad does.
He can't even hand it to somebody to get their phone number. He has to, that's a different pad.
It's a different pad for that. That's yeah. a different pad. Yeah.
I'm sorry, this is my brush off pad. Let me see. Where's my other one?
It's so funny too, because though what really sets up is the fact that he's kind of moving on from that character you knew in the first season. He's moving on from that character who was a little less annoying in the second season, and by this season he's really becoming his own character. And I really, you know, it's enjoyable that they can do that and show that to you in such a way that's really funny. That he's okay with Dax saying no and he's going to move on. And, you know, who hasn't had the AKA the cooler come in to use some new girl speak? That, you know, you have that girl that comes around and just kind of ruins your chances, you know, to get laid. And that's what Janzia is at this point. She's Bashir's cooler.
Or for our Voyager fans out there, Jadzia is the monkey in this episode.
Exactly. Or just a Harry Kim.
Oh, yeah. Talking about Jake going off to college, though, Landru, was anyone else nervous here? He receives a communication from New Zealand. Was anyone nervous that this whole writing thing was a ploy for someone to throw him into a penal colony? Were they trying to lure him back so they could put Jake into the New Zealand penal colony where he could meet? Because he suggests to his dad here that maybe he has joined the Maquis. Were they trying to get him there so he could hook up with Tom Paris and, you know, convey some information, something else going on there?
I don't know. Well,
Tom would still be in New Zealand right around this time, would he not?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he's just now serving his hard time. So
that's right. Jake is the messenger.
Interesting.
That would have been a really interesting thing, I think, to have Jake go that way. But it would have been really out of the blue all of a sudden have Jake become a Maquis traitor.
I mean, talk about giving Benjamin some depth. I mean, that would be like, you know, oh, the Maquis that you chased around that guy. Sure, you respected him and all that. But, you know, your son's a Maquis. Oh, he'd explode in anger.
That would have been great.
He would stutter all the time.
Jake, how could you join the Maquis?
The Maquis.
Well, the inspiration for this story is really interesting. Again, I mentioned, Ben, that when this episode first came on for me, watching through DS9, I was in university and I was a little bit more focused on the spaceship techie side of Star Trek then than I am now. Now I'm more focused on the character relationships and such. And this episode came on and I thought it was a little bit weird. I guess maybe kind of the way you did, Drew. It looked really different and it was just a different kind of story. But the inspiration for it is really interesting that I mentioned in the opening that this was pitched by Hilary Bader, who was an intern on the show at the time. And someone had been talking about how people used to explore in the old days of Earth, and they used to sail the seas the way Ben sailed the seas in the Navy. And they were exploring and they were, you know, trying to prove that things were possible. And they drew the parallels between the story of the Kon-Tiki and Heyerdahl, the Norwegian explorer who sailed from Peru to Tahiti. And I thought it was very interesting because they make this little solar sail ship really feel like a sailboat, especially inside. Mm-hmm. Even like when you're inside there, you feel like you're going down under in a large sailboat. You almost even have that kind of sensation of like a slight rocking a little bit, like you're
right.
The space surrounding you is kind of like the ocean. And I thought it was a very interesting inspiration. And here you have like Bajor is like South America and Peru, and Cardassia is Tahiti and the Polynesian Islands. And they're recreating this entire voyage, even down to the point where O'Brien warns them that there could be ion storms in the Denarius Belt, you know, as opposed to typhoons in the Pacific that are going to...
Here there be dragons.
Right, yeah. It was quite interesting. And that leads us to the design of the ship as well, and just the way they had to shoot the episode and the set design and everything. What did you guys think about this inspiration?
I think it makes the episode feel really real. You know, as fantastical as this all is, because it's based in something that's so real world, it I don't ever really question it. You know, I've watched this episode a bunch of times, and so this time I was kind of questioning some things like, how could they go to light speed, you know, without any internal dampers, which, wouldn't they just be jelly on the back of the wall, all that kind of thing. But because, you know, this really does have that real world feel of, you know, people trying new things and trying to prove something can happen, it resonates. And so I really don't question this, you know, the first few times I see it. You know, after you've seen it a bunch of times, you're looking for new things. But to me, I think that's what really sells the episode the first few times you watch it, is that I just resonate with somebody wanting to know. And I think it really speaks to the heart of what Star Trek was at the beginning. These are the Voyagers of the Starship Enterprise. You know, its continuing mission to seek out new life and new civilizations. You know, Sisko in this episode is trying to see what it was like to be an ancient Bajoran and really get inside their head and understand their lifestyle and what they went through. And that makes for a really cool and deep episode, in the same way that we might recreate, you know, an old ship and try and sail it to see what would happen, what it was like to be that person. And that really spoke, I think, to his character too, Sisko's character. And so to me, it just really works story-wise, because I immediately connect with it because I know those feelings as a human being.
I think, you know, basing a story on something, you know, as real as this, we in modern day, you know, with all of our technology and our iPhones and, you know, our gadgets and Androids, we kind of lose track or lose sight of the fact that, you know, 300, 400, 500 years ago, what explorers were actually doing. I mean, the planet's explored, we think, but then we have the, you know, this vastness of the ocean bottom that's never, we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about, you know, the bottom of the ocean. And so for us to think that, you know, how many hundreds of years ago that this voyage from Peru to Tahiti would have happened, you know, when we're still trying to get, you know, Columbus across the Atlantic, I mean, in big wooden, you know, huge galleon type ships compared to what the Contiki was, that, you know, ancient man could accomplish these things. What's the space equivalent? You know, our first little trips into space with Apollo and Gemini and Soyuz and those type vessels, you know, 800 years from now, 300 years from now, will look like, you know, like the Contiki. I mean, so what was that ancient equivalent? And I love that it sets up that the Bajorans, or it reiterates that the Bajorans were so far ahead of us. Because I think when they were introduced on TNG, Picard had remarked that, you know, their civilization was at its peak long before, you know, we were like crawling out of our little mud huts or whatever. So this is just another, you know, example of how far ahead that they were. I mean, they're doing interstellar space travel. I mean, even beyond that, they're doing space travel 800 years ago. So, and you kind of fall into the whole thing of, oh, the poor little Bajorans, this and that. But we're seeing them on the downside of their civilization, forgetting that, you know, this was like a pretty massive, you know, I don't know, spacefaring people.
Yeah, that was my question, too, was the Bajorans 800 years ago were able to build this, and Sisko doesn't want to use laser cutters on the wood or whatever because he wants to build it just like the ancient Bajorans did. And then we immediately cut to him in a 20th century welding mask, welding. Like, and they say it several times, like, oh, this ancient Bajoran ship, as they're, you know, tapping compads and stuff. Like, how advanced were they? Like, how did they get the sailing ship into space? I mean, it's wood and metal. I mean, like 800 years from now, I can understand us recreating Apollo and being like, that's really cool that they can't believe they did that. But I mean, like,
they had to use socket wrenches.
Yeah, they had to use socket wrenches. But Sisko's just like, I need to use a bandsaw and, you know, like an old cartoon.
I think there's some liberty being taken creatively because they also want to play on this analogy and this inspiration to ancient sailing ships on Earth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole design of the ship, especially the interior, it has this very Jules Verne inspired mm-hmm. look to it. It's very much like 20,000 Leagues Beneath the Sea kind of feeling. And, you know, with the polished brass and the wood and all the different textures, it feels very much like something that we would build, especially long ago, to explore the oceans. And so it's creatively really a challenge. One thing I like here is that they're able to take the established Bajoran aesthetic from the show and then roll it back 800 years, and it still feels Bajoran and it still works. And it's something that I liked. Of course, it's something I like about Enterprise too. I like the NX-01 because I feel like they did a good job of rolling the design backwards. And it's something I also like about the newer Star Wars movies, the prequels. The ship designs themselves, I feel like they did a good job of rolling back the ship designs that we know from the original trilogy and making it feel retro, like you're actually going backwards in time within that galaxy far, far away. But here, I think they did a good job of that with the Bajoran ship, but also marrying that with touches from our own culture. And so that's, I guess, why you have the bandsaw, and it's why you have the wood. I mean, you wouldn't actually use wood to build a ship you're going to put into space, right? It's not really going to protect you from radiation from your star or anything like that. So,
yeah, it seems like...
Well, use really thick wood.
Yeah.
Really, really
it's
thick.
It's Bajoran wood. I mean, maybe it does.
Well, there you go.
Well, it seems like space too, though, that's the inside of the ship. You know, like the Bajorans are very artistic people. And so for them, adding those artistic elements was, I think, probably one of their ways of, you know, living out their belief in the prophets, and that, you know, they had been given these abilities. And so they made things that are artistic in a way of worship, you know, in that sense. And so this is the same way that we built cathedrals hundreds of years ago, and you did all those amazing things because it was a way of worshiping God. Because we were using our creative talents to do that. And the Bajorans are very much in line with that kind of thinking. And so, you know, they do play around with how much the Bajorans are advanced at that point. And it does seem like that they have where we are now with the ability to get a solar sailor into, you know, launch. So we have iPads now and stuff that have all these touch technology. So I didn't see that as being so weird that you'd be doing touch technology with a solar sailor and putting all those things together to try and run the ship. And at the same time, giving us that aesthetic that we're familiar with, that makes it feel a little bit more like a rigging ship from our own oceans. You know, yeah. That's okay to me. It makes for a really, I think, beautiful set. I can't imagine how much they spent creating that set for, you know, Jake and well, Sisko to be in. It's really well done.
It didn't cost that much. They just sent Avery down to Home Depot, and they just let Avery build the whole set. That was all done in real time.
I can imagine.
They shot it as Avery was building
the set. I can see that now. Wait, I have to wear my uniform while I do this? Yeah. Or just put the comm badge on your regular clothes.
Oh, can I wear jeans?
Yeah, sure.
Is it a jeans day?
From the top, yeah.
I was losing track of how much time was supposed to be passing while he was building this. You know, the little montage. I expected some kind of 80s music playing in the background, you know, as he's putting this ship together. And then I remember, you know, from the teaser portion that it was, you know, well, the Lexington will be here in 3 weeks.
3 weeks, yeah.
And they're getting ready to launch. And then, oh, the Lexington's, you know, arriving. And I had, you know, Jenny and I were discussing this where it was just like, he did all that in 3 weeks and you never see anyone helping him through this whole...
He was doing his regular job.
Well, no, was he?
Yeah, see, that's...
I don't know, see?
Huh.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things, and Chris, this kind of leads into the next thing that we were going to talk about, I think. I think Sisko actually takes leave to do this because you don't see him working in any of that montage. He's just working on the solar cell. And to do this in 3 weeks, I mean, he would have to be working, you know, 12 to 16 hours a day to put this together, even with all the technology.
It must have been leave because I'm watching him build it. And like when Jadzia walks in and talks to him, and I'm thinking, doesn't this guy have a station to run also? Is he just down here building a ship all the time? So he must have taken some leave for this.
See, I'm still on the idea that he didn't because, well, when I first watched this was, you know, pretty early on. And so it was still kind of sore that this is a Star Trek that goes nowhere. You know, that was the old thing. You know, it's like Dodge City and the adventure comes to you type thing.
Yeah.
Well, what happens when there's no adventure coming to you? The Cardassians are kind of quiet. You know, there's no need to circle the wagons or whatever. So it's just, you know, we always skip the dull parts on Star Trek with, you know, like Next Generation or Enterprise, where they're going between the planets. We just see the action spots.
It's true.
Well, we get to see the lull in Deep Space Nine because there's nothing going on. And so he's able to literally take 3 weeks from his, you know, time. Anything going on today in ops? No, it's kind of dead. Yeah. All right, I'll be down the cargo bay making the sail ship.
Okay, well, that's a good point. Could be.
But where did he get the cargo bay? If he was doing it on his personal time, he couldn't, like, say, Starfleet needs his cargo bay. Or maybe he did.
Well, he's the captain of the station. He can take whatever he wants.
When the commander needs a cargo bay, the commander gets a cargo bay. I did notice some of the crates had Klingon labels on it, so it's not like you're really going to care.
It's not like it's going to rot.
It's just a Klingon sticking. Yeah, it's probably already rotted.
They'll like it better.
You can't tell.
Well, and that's something, though, that I felt like was really important that they were distinguishing for Sisko, that he is a man who is okay with taking time off from Starfleet to do something that's really important to him. You know, Picard has no life other than Starfleet, has to be forced to take vacation. But, you know, Benjamin has been through hell and back. He's watched his wife die, get destroyed by the Borg. He's almost lost his son because of that, too. I think he's a man who understands that there's more important things in life than just this duty that you are signed up for, that you are given leave on purpose. It's okay to be interested and maybe even a little obsessed about something that's not just work. And I think that was really interesting to watch a captain, which, I mean, we talked about he's about to be introduced to Cassidy as well. I mean, this is a man who understands there's more to life than being a starship commander.
And this is the first time that we've seen that. I mean, because you got to think, this is the third commander in Star Trek that we've ever seen. Before this, I mean, we've only had Picard and Kirk.
Right.
And Kirk is married to the Enterprise. I mean, he was able to overcome, like, the tears of the that no man can resist. I mean, but he was able to break that because of his love for the Enterprise. But Picard, I mean, you have to force him to take leave. He's, I mean, 22 years in space, and it's like, yeah, whatever. You know, from the time he was a lieutenant until he was a captain, he's out in space, no time for family.
Yeah, how much leave has he accrued by insurrection? Like, he had like a whole year.
Oh, yeah, he has like 385 days worth of leave coming or something. It's ridiculous. Yeah,
so over a year. Enormous. But like Matthew's saying, I mean, this is the first time we see a family man.
Yeah.
Well, not, I mean, so much a first time we see a family man, but first time we see the family man in charge. I mean, like O'Brien has Keiko and Molly, and, you know, you have families, and that's kind of like on the peripheral, but for this to be, you know, the commanding officer now is a single dad. How does, you know, how does this fit into Star Trek, and how does this break the mold of the captains we've seen?
Yeah. And Sisko really seems like an actual father. And, you know, Ben, you and I both have children, and we know what it's like to be a father. And Sisko really is a father here. Whereas O'Brien, yeah, he has Molly and, of course, later Kirayoshi, but O'Brien never feels like a father to me. It feels like he has his family that's in his quarters, but otherwise he's doing all his other stuff on the station all the time. And there are moments where he seems like a family guy, but not to the extent of Sisko, where with Sisko, you really feel that he really truly is a father who has his hands in all these aspects of Jake's life and the way that we have with our own children. And we get to see that along the way. And we especially get to see it in this episode.
Mm-hmm. Well, and two, getting to see Benjamin be this way, I think is really key because, you know, Ben, you were talking about how, you know, things don't, you know, things come to the station or whatever, but this is one of those episodes where a character is making something happen and mm-hmm. for themselves, you know, like and Benjamin's making this happen for himself and then for Jake. And I think that that was one of those things that it kind of set itself apart from some of the other Deep Space Nine episodes where a lot of things just happen to the characters. You know, Benjamin is in this episode really actively making this happen for himself and going and seeking out a new experience that we've kind of seen in the other shows. But it's usually just because they run across another, you know, alien race. This time, Benjamin's actively seeking it out, which I thought was really interesting because it just really plays into what we think of when we think of Star Trek and seeking, you know, new life, new civilizations, and really trying to understand them. And this is one of those things that sets Deep Space Nine apart as well, is that we are going to put to test what it's like to live in the 24th century. You know, we don't really understand that because the Enterprise just moves from planet to planet, you know, system to system. They don't have a lot of experience, or we don't see what the experience is of
what
it's like to live though in the 24th century Federation. And Deep Space Nine gives us what it's like to actually, okay, what's it like to be a family man and have a family in this world? What's it like to live with these values every single day in the same place? And I think that's what, you know, as more people watch Deep Space Nine now, they're really finding this, is that, okay, well, I saw this in The Next Generation, but this show is kind of giving me what it's actually like to live in this universe instead of just kind of maybe exist in it.
I think O'Brien being on DS9 is really good for this, because we saw O'Brien on The Next Generation. And here, especially the scene we'll talk about in a little while with Jules in the quarters when they're drinking, you get to see Bashir behind the scenes. Instead of seeing him working the transporter or being on the bridge or helping out Geordi or whatever he's going to do on The Next Generation, doing his job in action, here we get to see the flip side of that. We get to see everything that he's doing with the rest of his time. So having that same character on both, I think it is a great connection. Bringing him on the show was a really great move.
Yeah. My thing with Sisko being obsessed with building this thing in the next 3 weeks and then taking his son and an undefended ship into enemy territory is, so it's a Bajoran thing. It's like, it's something, hey, I found this, I should do this. Like, maybe if he wanted to build it with Jake, like, let's see if we can do this and not just travel with him, maybe it would make more sense. And when he first became obsessed with it, I was like, is this some kind of emissary thing? Is like this proof or something the prophets are guiding him to do? And then it just all works out. Yes, you proved that the Bajorans did it. They went to Cardassia 800 years ago. And I mean, were the prophets guiding his obsession, maybe?
That's a good question. I've never thought about that. I mean, it's never addressed, but it's interesting to think, like, maybe they were.
Because I'm always trying to find this, the whole emissary thing, because it's still, you know, halfway through the fourth season, still really hasn't come up again. Every time that he's doing something with Bajor, I'm like, maybe this is something special.
I think that as I watch through the seasons again now, and I'm really cognizant of what happens at the end with Sisko, I'm able to see just how much Bajor itself kind of pulls him in. And I'm sorry about this, Drew, but later on when he says that he never thought that he would fall in love with a place like this as he did Bajor, he just came. It was a job to him. He was going to do it and leave, but it became something so much more. Is that they really slowly and kind of methodically kind of play that out, that he begins to fall in love with this place. And so I think this is just one of those episodes where you kind of see Sisko falling in love with the place and its history and its people and its background in a way that can only happen if you're somewhere longer than, you know, a few weeks. And and of course, being the emissary too, it plays in later on that you've watched him kind of slowly build up this love affair with Bajor, its people, its history, its culture, what it is, what it begins to mean to him. And it's subtle. It's not really in your face until really that fifth season when you hit Rapture and it really smacks you in the head.
Cool. just as I hoped.
Did you guys also notice, it's very subtle, you have to be paying attention, but when Sisko tells Jake about the ship, and Sisko says, and I'm going to build one, the look on Jake's face is like this, Matthew. It's like, again, Dad, really? You get so obsessed with things.
Well, and it's funny because I realized, Chris, when I was watching this episode again, he is a shipbuilder. I mean, he helped create the Defiant. He helped build the Defiant.
Oh, that's true.
So yeah. This is not something I don't think that comes out of the blue. I mean, they've already set up that Sisko has a desire and a love for shipbuilding by helping build the Defiant. And so this, I think, when he's smacked in the face with kind of the beauty and the simplicity of the ship, it draws something out in the same way that, you know, in Generations when Picard and Riker are on that HMS Enterprise and they're talking about just the love of the wind and their hair and just imagine what it would be like. This is that episode for Sisko. He's imagining and he's getting to live out what it was like to enjoy the silence of space, because there isn't a hum of an engine. There isn't any of that hubbub, you know. It's just you and what you've created to get you somewhere. It's pretty awesome.
It really says a lot that Sisko actually physically built it in a cargo bay and not, like, you know, pretended to build it in the holodeck or just had the computer build it. And then, I mean, because I feel like Picard would do like they did with the HMS Enterprise, kind of, you know, I want to be on a sailing ship. So he builds a sailing ship in the computer.
Well, that's what O'Brien tells him. You know, a computer model could do this. He says, why go to all that trouble? And Sisko says, because it'll be fun.
Yeah, and that's really why. Telling about Sisko. It's that, like, knowing is half the battle.
Which reminded me of Kirk and climbing mountains. Exactly. And they ask why you climb. Well, because it's there.
Well, and it goes to a little bit of what Data and Picard talk about in First Contact, where, you know, they're touching the Phoenix, and that there's something about actually being able to touch whatever it is. It creates in you a sense of bond that isn't there. So for Sisko, it's, you know, a computer model could tell me something, but it's not real life. It's not actually happening. I won't experience it. I won't get to touch it and feel it and taste it and see it all happen to me. And that is more than, you know, and computer models can be wrong. And so Sisko doing this is really that ability to sense with his own senses what is happening to him. And I think that that's a really interesting message of this episode that maybe I hadn't thought about before, but that there's something better of experience. You know, Jake even talks about, I want to stay on Deep Space Nine because I want to get some more experience. And what better place to get it as a writer than Deep Space Nine? That there's something better about having experienced life than just having played it life on computer models. I mean, it's a big deal. I think that's a really cool message that's hidden in this episode that, you know, if you're just kind of watching, you know, you might miss if you're not paying attention.
And maybe that plays into the B plot even, when it's revealed that Bashir's, you know, enemy is jealous of him and his assignment. You know, she's on this big, bad Nebula class ship, and she's just like, it's really boring. You know, I'd love to be here with, you know, experiencing things instead of just going from place to place.
Going back to that tactile response, feeling things that you were talking about, Matthew, how do you guys feel about ebooks now? Because I buy ebooks because they're easy for me to get here in Japan. Mm-hmm. It's cheaper, and I don't have space to store hundreds of books. But I love hardcover books. If I really love holding a hardcover book and turning the actual pages. And I feel like, you know, the younger generations now growing up, everything is digital to them. And I don't know if we're losing something there, because, you know, I'll buy the ebooks because, if I want to read a book, I can just da-da-da, and it's there on my iPad and I can read it. But I miss that physical sensation of holding a book.
I travel a lot for my day job and take a lot of flights, and I always have a paperback with me. Because, I mean, the obvious advantage is the battery never goes dead, and I don't have to turn it off when I take off. But there's something about a physical book. Mm-hmm. I mean, I recently moved, and I've got like three shelves that are just packed with books that I've collected over the years. And there is something about that tactile. It's more real.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I have a ton of ebooks that I go through. And now that comics are more readily available in digital format, I've not bought a comic book in ages, but I've still got, you know, 12 half boxes, you know, sitting in the closet with old Silver Age stuff that I collected and some Bronze Age stuff, because there's just something about those. These will be worth nothing ever, but it's, you know, oh, this was, you know, I got this in, you know, 1986, and it was, you know, I can still remember when I, you know, got some of these certain issues. But when you touch it, you feel it. It doesn't go away. It's a real thing. And you have that, I don't know, something in your gut that just, it feels real, where, like you're saying with the ebooks, it, you know, it could just all go away. Ephemeral. It's just to the ether. It's gone.
I think that there's something too, for me, you know, I also read a ton of ebooks because it's easier for me. I ride the train every day. It's better not to have to carry three or four books that I might be reading. It's difficult. But for me, when a book is really important, I always buy, like Chris, the hardcover, because I'm going to want it on the shelf too. It's kind of a badge of honor. You know, I'm reading a history book or whatever. It's 800 pages. I want that, you know, bad boy on my shelf. So people are like, oh, you slogged through that. And I was like, no, I didn't slog through that. It was excellent. You know, that kind of thing. But there is something that makes it more special, more real, to me when I buy the book and I, you know, I open up the book and I'm touching the pages and I'm turning them and reading it. To me, it means that book is different than just, say, your average paperback mystery or whatever that you kind of picked up, you know, as you know, Ben, you said you're at the airport. You know, for me, I don't like paperbacks. They're annoying to me. But if that book is special, I'm going to buy that in hardcover. I'm going to read it because it's significant to me that this book has some meaning beyond just I'm enjoying a good story or whatever. So I buy that and I put it on the shelf and I take up space in my home. You know, that book has a purpose for me beyond just I enjoyed a good story.
Mm. One of the things with me living here on the East Coast near D.C., I've visited the Smithsonian a few times. And as we know, you know, the Enterprise, the original, you know, NCC 1701 is hanging there. And they won't let you get but so close, and there's a nice protective glass that, much like visiting the Phoenix for Picard and Data, when, you know, just to reach out and touch, you stare at that glass and just wish that you could just reach out and touch that piece of history. If I could just gently touch my fingers to it and feel connected to Roddenberry and the history that, you know, that came from that one model, that one ship. And so I think, you know, coming back to this, though, you know, trying to tie it into this episode, when they're rigging the sails, how real is that? I mean, that your whole space flight, this whole epic, you're so in touch with it. I mean, that in the 24th century, we've become so distanced from actual space flight. You're in a Hilton in space. I mean, is what the Enterprise was called at one point, because you can't even feel the hum of the engines, according to Scotty. You know, he could tell you what, you know, speed they were going by the vibration, but the Enterprise D, there's none of that. So for these two guys, you know, Jake and Benjamin, to go out and you're turning the sails, you're cranking things into place, the ship is moving and you feel that movement. How real would that have to be to somebody from that kind of environment? But you see what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, it's this realism that I think for someone from their time would be so separated from that it would be a thrill. It would be this energy that you would get from cranking a sail or from you know, navigating the ship with a bar from the ceiling like they were doing. You know, thankfully, they didn't have the big spinny wheel like on the Enterprise A.
Oh, yeah.
Hard to port her.
Well, and I think what you were just saying, Ben, really leads into the fact that this is an episode about really two different relationships, one of father and son and one of two people mm-hmm. who are becoming best friends, and just the kind of the realness, the reality of that, you know. And I think in some ways for me, a lot of that's what was missing from The Next Generation, was that lack of really connected feeling between the characters. Like, these people live together, they experience life together, they do things together. But this is a whole episode where, you know, Sisko builds this ship, he really wants his son to be a part of it, but he's also trying to be a good father and let that son go and experience mm-hmm. things on his own. And then his son luckily comes to him and says, no, I want to be a part of this with you, and they experience this adventure together. And then on the other side you have Bashir and O'Brien, where, you know, O'Brien, against his better judgment, is beginning to like this guy and really sympathize with this poor guy who's, you know, he feels down because, you know, this girl has everything that he thought he wanted, you know, and then he's really embarrassed, and the reality of, you know, O'Brien must be putting himself in the shoes of Bashir and saying, okay, I know what this guy's going through. It's terrible. So let's get drunk together and we'll forget it in the morning. Just that realness, that authentic relationship is really, I think, what drives this episode. And it all comes together, I think, and in just being, you know, something that speaks volumes, in the same way that I want to buy a hardcover book. Well, this is a hardcover book of Star Trek. Like, it's a real, honest mm-hmm. episode that you can just dive into and find some new things every time you watch it.
I like the parallel that you bring up, that you have with Benjamin, someone who's experienced, who's lived life, who's had a, you know, a longer life than Jake, and Jake is coming up, and so he's the inexperienced one. Where now with Julian and Miles has definitely lived life. I mean, even though he's enlisted, he's a senior enlisted, he's done time on multiple starships, he's, you know, he's seen war, he's, you know, gone through a lot, he has a family. And Julian is fresh out of school, this is his first assignment type thing. And so he's the inexperienced one. So I like that parallel.
Matthew, you mentioned at this point that Miles, against his better judgment, is starting to like Bashir. But are you sure he's starting to like Bashir? Because what he said was that he doesn't hate him anymore. Yes.
Well, and
from the heart. Exactly. That is from the heart.
That's from the heart.
Joe, I really do not hate you.
I really do not hate you. No, I think that what he's doing in so many words there is what so many men have a problem doing, is expressing their emotions. And he's trying to say, basically, dude, I like you. I love spending time with you. Can we be bros? But he can't.
I wish you were Keiko.
Exactly. Yeah. He can't get that out. But I think it's such a fantastic relationship because it is very, again, authentic and true to life, that lots of times as men, we really feel that way about that guy. We want to say it, but the only way we can get it out is like, I don't hate you as much as I used to. In fact, I don't hate you at all. I mean, I'm not going to go as far as saying I like you.
Yeah. People either love you or hate you, and I don't hate you.
Yeah, exactly. So that's and there you go. Drew, you just pointed out, he says those words.
Yes,
you either,
he does.
You either love you or hate you, and I don't hate you anymore. So what he's saying is, I love you. He's just not going to say those three little words.
I think it's interesting with this friendship, though, because this is quite possibly one of the strongest, you know, friendships that we've seen in Star Trek since Kirk and Spock.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, and that has its own issues with the whole Vulcan and the logic and no emotion or hide your emotions thing. But this is just two human men who develop, you know, as we see over the rest of the series, a very strong, you know, would die for each other type friendship. And it's interesting to watch, you know, at this early stage, how that's really starting to coalesce.
Yeah.
Definitely. That whole scene, I just love the entire scene. Yes. There in the quarters.
They're both very good playing drunk.
Colm Meaney plays it so well. It's why I like O'Brien and it's why I like Colm. Mm. He may be acting, but I never feel like he's acting. It's just him. He's just there. He's just this ordinary guy that everyone can associate with.
Yeah, I love Miles. He's just the guy. In one of the other episodes I watched today, like, everything's breaking and Worf is complaining, like, everything breaks. Things didn't break on the Enterprise. And he's like, I know, it was so freaking boring.
Well, and it's great too, because I really like that Deep Space Nine kind of sets itself apart. You know, Miles is like, I think it's time for us to switch to Synthahol. And Bashir's like, this is not a Synthahol night. Like, you don't drink Synthahol with this. You know, like that reality of, no, I want to be inebriated. I do not want to be able to shake this off. I want to pay for it in the morning. I just love that reality that they're giving you in this show of these two guys. No, I'm going to pay for this in the morning. It's going to be fine. I'll take a little hypo spray or something that'll help out, but I'm going to be sad about this in the morning because this is embarrassing. You know, I'm going through something here. I want to feel it.
So Bashir is all upset because this woman, Lenz, what an interesting name, right? Elizabeth Lenz, was the valedictorian instead of Bashir. And now he has it in his mind that she hates him. Bashir thinks, well, maybe she just walked past because she didn't recognize me. But O'Brien's like, no, what if she just walked past you because she hates you? it's the case.
And that's a good friend
right there.
Bashir's
got all this stuff. Yeah, tell it like it is, Miles. And Bashir's got all this stuff in his head about her. And I guess I have two questions about this whole part of the story here. But the first one, of course, is just playing up that we kind of need to not build everything up in our head all the time. Sometimes you need to actually talk to people. Mm-hmm. And I see that with friends of mine all the time, that they've got this whole scenario built up in their heads about some situation. And maybe I know that it's not actually the reality, you know, because I know the other person as well. But I think we all do this, right? Mm. We all paint the scenario in our heads. Yeah. You know, I sometimes paint the scenario in my heads about clients and how a project's going and how I think they're reacting from the other side. And it's actually not really what's going on. And so here we do need to learn to talk to people.
Well, and that's one of those things is that we really do in life is that we tell ourselves stories about people with what we know about them without confirming by really asking them the questions that would give us the answers that we need to know if that's actually the truth. So by telling these stories, we kind of fill in the gaps with what we know, but they don't always end up being reality because we don't know everything. And we're kind of afraid to ask that question will let us know the answer to the question. It's a little bit easier a lot of times to just create the story ourselves and believe it the same way Bashir is. Whereas the hard thing to do is having to go up to her and say, do you not remember me? And then, you know, obviously it turns out she thought he was somebody else the whole time. That's right. Why she didn't recognize him.
We're always cautious because we're afraid, whatever it is, if we ask the person for the truth, we're going to find out that they think we're an Andorian.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed that she wasn't more paranoid. I mean, like, because if he knew she was on that, and so she knew that Dr. Bashir was on Deep Space Nine, shouldn't she have had, like, been, like, warily looking for him, afraid that he was going to jump out and attack her?
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
Yeah. Because Andorians love their fight scenes.
Surprise, right. Out of nowhere.
Yeah, you were valedictorian over me. I'm going to take you out.
That's right.
And she knew about the preganglionic nerve thing. So, like, she knew a lot about him to think he was an Andorian.
Exactly. That was the whole deal. She was nervous coming on the station. She probably tried to get the Lexington to dock somewhere else. She's like, I'm going to go on there, this Bashir guy. I was valedictorian. He had to settle for being salutatorian. He's an Andorian. He's going to kick my ass.
He's going to cut me in my preganglionic nerve.
I think, though, one thing, though, with their discussion and her description of life on the Lexington, like we were discussing earlier with the differences between previous Treks and DS9, she described life as a science or medical officer on the previous Treks to a T.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you don't have time for that. We land, get samples, you know, disease of the week, and we're out. And, you know, she was actually jealous. And it seems like, to a degree, they were trying to still sell us on Deep Space Nine. Where even Starfleet officers want to be here, you know. Oh, yeah, I'd love to have the kind of time that you have. And it made me kind of think, you know, differently a little bit because, well, yeah, you know, we've never had a chance to sit in one place. And actually, like we discussed earlier, and Matthew had brought up and everyone, that we never have had this chance to sit and explore, you know, close space and really get to know a place and really get to, you know, dig into it. And she's making the same complaint, you know. It's that boring time in between planets, and then it's really active. And now let's be bored again, because as we know, all the adventure happens on Enterprise, so all the other starships go around collecting samples and you know occasionally show up as backup players.
Well, and it
occasionally they need to come and get blown up.
Oh, another ship! You're not going to last very long.
It just speaks to the reality too of space travel, that there aren't inhabited worlds every, you know, few light years. Yeah. It would be months, she said, before they find anything interesting.
And what was it, moss under a rock?
Mm-hmm. And that's really important, because we always think from watching the Star Trek that it's just this awesome experience every 5 seconds, you know, we're running into something, but you know, there's space itself, most of it is just dead space. It's just expanding space, you know, and 300
space is really
big. 300 years from now, every planet that we know will have expanded even farther away from us. So, you know, when you're traveling at warp speed, it's fast, but there's still not as much out there as Star Trek and, you know, The Next Generation, you know, all those shows really made it seem like. And so, at least Deep Space Nine talked about that. And, you know, a few times you would get Voyager talking about just how boring it was, that they're not in a part of space that's interesting at all. They're just traveling. And it's, you know, we need to go to Fairhaven. That was for Tristan.
Well, my other question, I said I had two questions about Bashir here, is that knowing what we know about Bashir later on, knowing why he missed that question on the test, when he talks about it here, and the fact that she became valedictorian, and we know that in reality, he let her become valedictorian in order to kind of protect his secret. Does that change the way you see this whole situation with Elizabeth Lenz when you watch this episode now?
That he jeopardized, because he really wanted to be on DS9. And so he put that in jeopardy by maintaining his cover. Type thing.
Yeah, because he didn't necessarily have first choice by not being valedictorian, right? Yeah.
I think it just goes to prove just how much, you know, when you watch those later episodes, you know that he's genetically enhanced, how much he had to sacrifice to not be himself. You know, he's really, at this point, you know, when we watch it back, he's playing a role. But I also think that there's a big part of him that his sorrow is that he couldn't just be valedictorian and get the post that he wanted and be proud of that. He has to pretend to be not as smart and not as good as he actually is. Mm-hmm. And that speaks to all those identity issues that come up with, you know, being a person who feels like you have to hide who you really are from people because they won't like you or love you or whatever, if you really are. And that's kind of a damaging thing. And you watch, you know, him as a character kind of overcome that finally throughout the last few seasons. But it just, it makes me feel for him when I rewatch these kind of episodes and realize that he's having to lie about who he is in as a person. Mm-hmm. That's a tough thing.
It's almost as if he's the Clark Kent of the Star Trek universe. Right. Where, I mean, you know, the classic 1978 Clark Kent, that right. the bumbling, you know, can't do anything right. Meanwhile, he could end, you know, or save every life on the planet just on a whim.
Exactly.
And, you know, he's the Star Trek Superman.
Right.
I mean, he's the augment that works.
He is. Well, we've passed an hour in this discussion, so let's wrap up with our final thoughts. And Drew, what are your final thoughts on Explorers?
Well, at first, I was disappointed that it wasn't pushing forward the Dominion storyline or the Emissary storyline or any of the big arcs that I was sold on. But after talking it over with you guys, I can see that it's more about the arc of Deep Space Nine, which is these characters. And this episode is important for these characters. It establishes a lot of the bromance and Leeta and Cassidy and all these things that are major points. And so I respect it more. I respect it more than I did before. And I guess I would give it 12 transporter rations out of an unknown number.
Excellent. What about you, Matthew?
Well, I think, I don't know, I guess I've waxed eloquent about this episode and really how much I love it, so I feel like there's not a ton that I can add. But I really like this episode. I love its character development. I love the fact that it took time to slow down to tell us about these characters in a really authentic way, whether it's Bashir and O'Brien together and really cementing that friendship, or it was Sisko and telling us a lot about who he was as a captain, what drove him beyond Starfleet, the fact that he has a very curious mind and he wants to know himself and experience for himself in the same way I think that all, you know, great Star Trek characters do. They really want to discover. And Sisko really allows us to do that in some different ways from our other captains we've seen. So I think this is a great episode. If you just want to understand that Deep Space Nine is going to talk about people in real ways, this is a great episode to show that to anyone. It's, you know, it's not ridiculously exciting, you know, not a ton of explosions except for the end with the nice fireworks you get. But I would say this episode is 10 out of 12 go away pads.
Very good. How about you, Ben?
You know, I have to agree with Matthew on a lot of this, and part of it is because having not seen it in so long, you know, as you'd mentioned earlier, you and I are both fathers. And with sons who are starting to go out into the world now, I can look back and I look at this with a different, or through a different lens, I guess, and not the Elizabeth one. But, you know, it's a different way, this father-son relationship that's really set up over the course of the series. And this is a great episode for a father-son because, I mean, you could have added a whole angsty level to it if it was a lesser show where, you know, he doesn't want to go. And then, you know, Sisko and someone else goes on this 4-day cruise and he just, you know, complains about how he's losing contact with his son or whatnot. But instead we get this bonding experience between the two of them. And this is, hey, I need some time alone with my dad to talk about, you know, going possibly to this school. And he just wants to spend, you know, time with his son as his son's growing up. And so I think that was, I don't know, I think that stood out to me this time through, that dynamic. And at the same time, just, you know, having friends, I, you know, have since watching this episode and having lived a lot more life, you know, having that friend that you can get drunk with and commiserate over something is, you know, definitely something that you need in your life sometimes. And so it was unique for me, looking back, I guess, you know, with the decades in between, you know, the different way that I watched it. Because the first time, it was all about the starships. It was all about the special effects. This time, you really pick up on the relationships. My rating would be, I would say probably 10 solar cells out of 12.
Wow, I like we're on this 12 system here today. I like this.
We must all have six-fingered right hands. We work on the, you know, six-fingered scale, so.
Yes.
It reminds me of the comics that we just did on literary.
Exactly.
You were the, yes. The guys have six fingers on each hand, so they have a base 12 counting system. Yeah. Yeah, I'm totally with you, Ben. It's the same situation for me. And when I watch this episode now, it's all about Sisko and Jake because I'm in the same situation now with my son at that age. You know, he's going to be 14 this year. He now wants to be off with his friends doing things. It's exactly what Benjamin is saying in this episode. It's exactly the situation. And so I can associate completely with it. And it highlights what I love about Star Trek too, is that, you know, 20 years ago when I watched this episode, 18 years ago, I guess is when it actually came on, like you, Ben, it was about the starships and it was about all this. And then now here we are now. And I get this completely different thing out of the same episode that was written then. And that's just brilliant. And also, you know, I love the creative aspects of this episode, the solar sail, the whole design of that ship and the way they brought it together and the looks of the ship, the costume design, the lighting, the photography, everything about the interior of the ship in particular is just so beautifully done. And the scoring of it as well. You know, Dennis McCarthy talked about how he loved scoring this episode because he didn't have to compete with that engine rumble that's going on all the time on Star Trek. And you have this soaring kind of inspirational vision of the ship soaring through space. And he used harp in here and he made the music very inspirational. And I love that. And the way they can combine that with the classic, you know, 19th century science fiction like the Jules Verne stuff is really nice as well. And this episode also won the Best Vision of the Future Award from the Space Frontier Foundation because of its portrayal of solar cells, because that's seen as a possible future for us in terms of propulsion that we need to really take to the stars. And it's a very creative approach here. So I love all these different things about the episodes. I love most that it is really about the characters and it does have this father-son relationship going on. So I'm going to give this episode one giant tachyon Eddie. All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys, to talk about Explorers. Before we go, Landru, tell everyone where they can find you around the internet.
Well, they can find me on Twitter at 005, DOUBLEOFIVE. They can also find me on Star Trek Rivals. I don't know my code, but you can ask for it on Twitter.
You can meet Drew's red matter card that he likes to throw into the middle of the board.
Oh, yeah. Just randomly. I'll just start with it sometimes. Aha! And you can also find me on the TOS episodes of The Ready Room, which will be coming up in a few weeks.
Yeah, just a few weeks. And Ben, where can people find you around the internets?
Well, after our extended hiatus, Jenny and I are updating once again at playingdoctorpodcast.com, which is our Doctor Who podcast. And you can find me on Twitter at realityamuck. So,
excellent.
I'm always up for a good Star Trek conversation.
All right, great. Well, thanks again, guys. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Chris, that was an awesome conversation about Explorers. You know, when I recommended the episode, I wasn't sure exactly how it would go because it is a quieter episode. But I think we really touched on some great issues, even pulled out some, you know, great themes from the episode that could actually mean something in our everyday life. And I also feel like we probably could have talked about the episode maybe another hour and still had a lot to say. So what a good episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
It really was, yeah. When you suggested it, I wasn't sure. I even asked you for some other suggestions. So we had a few choices because I wasn't sure my memory of the episode was such that I didn't know if we would be able to get as much discussion out of it as I was hoping for. But then I watched it and I said, wow, this is a perfect choice. And as you said, I think we could have talked for another hour about it because we didn't go into the father-son relationship nearly as much as I did in my own personal notes. And we didn't talk about Miles and Jules as much or any of that either. So, but that's not the only thing we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. So here, everyone, is a look at what else you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
Vic Fontaine.
Just something about kind of a wisecracking, smart-ass, you know, 60s rat packer seemed to fit with this group on Deep Space Nine.
The Ready Room.
The Nth Degree.
And I feel like he paved the way for neurotic Starfleet character, so we got Hoshi in Enterprise. So I think we can thank Barclay for allowing us to accept neurotic characters in Starfleet.
Deck 8.
The State of STO.
I think we're going to see some Bedeans in the game soon, so hide your organs, guys.
Hide your organs.
To the journey!
Tough love.
Janeway is really tough on Harry in this episode. She orders him to break up with his girlfriend.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
The Shrinking Man.
You're going to go from 1/7 to maybe just shy of zero, but then the next day, poof, you turn into zero.
Warp 5.
An Enterprise sampler.
The studio didn't really want to go that far back in terms of a prequel, that we do eventually get the chance to see that and know that this is really where the writers' hearts were.
Trek News and Views.
Voyager Season 7.
This is the thing, this, I know the Doctor is created in the image of Zimmerman and Zimmerman's bold and blah blah blah, but surely to God, if you was creating an alter ego of yourself, you would give yourself hair.
Literary Treks.
TNG Ghosts.
You pull things out one by one, one by one, and then the computer keeps bringing it down until you've got like four or five left, and then you stick them on a pad and you go have a staff meeting about it.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of those shows. We have a new show for you every day of the week. Some days we have two shows for you, talking Star Trek from all across the Star Trek franchise. So check those out. Go to trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to find all the shows in one place and get links to all the many different ways that you can hear the shows. Well, let's tell everyone where to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on Explorers or anything else that we talked about in news today. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. If you'd like to send us a voicemail, and we do encourage you to do this because we would love to hear your voice, you can do that from any page on the website. Just look along the right-hand side of any page. You'll see a tab that says Send Voicemail. If you click that tab, a box will pop up, and you can use your webcam's microphone to record a message for us, and you can upload it to us as an MP3 file right there from the page. If you'd like to join in a bigger discussion with other listeners and the Trek FM crew, drop by our forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for the Ready Room. There's one for Deep Space Nine, and you can chat away there. If you're on Facebook, you'll find us at facebook.com/trekfm. And of course, you'll always find us on Twitter, tweeting away about Star Trek under username TrekFM. Now, Matthew, what if people would like to look you up personally? Where should they go?
Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I also have my own website at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com, just writing about movie reviews, book reviews, and other things that just kind of come into my brain. And then, of course, Chris, we also do The Orb. So we talk Deep Space Nine all the time on The Orb. So if you enjoy just hearing about this episode, check us out there. We have an awesome time getting to talk about our favorite Star Trek series. And then we also do Literary Treks, books and comics of the Star Trek universe. I'm really diving into those. I'm excited. It's a great place if you really enjoy Star Trek and you're missing, say, the Prime universe. Well, the books are the place to go. So we hope we'll find you there. Now, Chris, if we're going to find you and you're hopefully not too inebriated from your evening with O'Brien, where could we find you?
Well, you know, that it's going to be tough, you know, because it's not a Synthale night. We're going for the real stuff here. So it's quite likely that might happen. But if you want to find me, You can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username. And Matthew, like you, I do have my own website. It's cbrianjones.com. So if you're interested in reading some of my writing on non-Star Trek things or looking at some of my photos or find out what kind of music I like and all kinds of other stuff, just drop by there, cbrianjones.com. And apart from the orb, Matthew, of course, we do literary treks together every week where we talk Star Trek books and comics. So you can find me on there. And you can find me with Kate Walsh every week on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. If you are a fan of the NX-01, if you're thinking about dropping $4,000 for that artisan replica, that's definitely the show for you. So come visit me over there as well. Matthew, before we go, we'd also like to ask everyone to please support our sponsors for this week's show. First, there's Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, online store, anything you can imagine. Go create your own space today. I promise you're going to love it. Go to squarespace.com for your free 14-day trial and then use offer code TREK8 to save 10%. And remember, if you choose the annual plan, you'll get that free custom domain registration as well. So we really thank Squarespace for their support of the Ready Room and Trek FM. Also, please visit trekfan.org. I love talking about Star Trek, Matthew. I know you do too. But if we just sit around and talk all the time, we're never going to get to that Star Trek future. We're never going to build that warp drive or that transporter. We're never going to build that ancient Bajoran solar cell ship and go all the way to Cardassia so Dukat can shoot fireworks at us. It's not going to happen. What you need to do is you need to go to trekfan.org, where you'll collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles and complete real-life mission objectives. And you'll also win great prizes along the way. So turn your love for Star Trek into something that can help move us all toward that future we love. Support us and Trek Fan by visiting trekfan.org. Solve that first puzzle and take your next step on your adventure. And we thank Trek Fan for their support of Trek FM as well. And lastly, if you would personally like to support the network, you can do that too. We have a way for you to do that. Go to trek.fm/donate. We have 8 new alien-themed badges as a thank you for your contribution that are perfect for your shirt, for your bag, for your dress uniform. They're 44mm badges with original illustration by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the art that you see on our website. We also have art prints of these aliens now that you can choose, and they're beautiful. I have larger views of these aliens. So go to trek.fm/donate, choose your level of contribution, choose the badges or art prints that you'd like to have, and your donations help us cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring this programming to you every week. Well, Matthew, you know, after this, I need to relax. I'm going to wander down to O'Brien's quarters. I'm going to, you know, have a drink with Miles and Jules. I'm going to sing Jerusalem with them, and I'm just going to have a good time for the rest of the night.
Chris, that sounds like a great idea. And I think it's time to stick a Bajoran book of fairy tales in it, because the Ready Room is done.
Recording. Ancient Bajoran phaser pants.
Oh.
Exactly. Is this the bathroom?
Wait for me. How does it work? No,
it's ancient Bajoran parachute pants. Oh. I'm sure that in the equivalent of the 1980s for Bajor, they all had, yeah, there was like Vedic Hammer, and Vedic Hammer had these parachute pants made out of the same stuff as the solar cells.
Can't touch this.
Can't sail this.
Dukat says, "That's just an old ancient Bajoran fairy tale. No one could sail those pants."
Oh, Dukat.